like that version of Afghanistan that Stuart Altman gave us for Obamacare. But in the back of the quality chasm, if you want to go back and look at it, you'll see an organization chart of the healthcare system, which I think Steve Shortell put together, and I've kind of collapsed it down to posit that health system performance is heavily influenced by two types of systems, microsystems and macrosystems. Microsystems are the place where I, as a physician, and I, as a hospital manager, try to work and negotiate. There are things like admitting departments and ICUs and doctors and offices and nurses' offices and catheterization suites. And they are the place where the rubber hits the road, where care is delivered. Macrosystems are the things that most healthcare providers are totally unaware of in their daily work. I assure you they're totally unaware of them, except for brief glimpses of awareness, and usually, which usually occasion anger. And they include things like the way payment systems, the structure of the insurance industry, how we accredit healthcare organizations, government regulations, that whole set of things that create the force field in which providers of care and patients come together to do what they need to do to provide healthcare. So we know a lot about microsystems, but it has never gotten translated into practice. So there was reference today in conversations about islands of excellence. And I can assure you that if you look at the literature on things like computerized decision support, reminder systems, lean technology, continuous quality improvement, computerized provider order entry, and a range of other innovations that have been tested within particular parts of organizations, you will find plenty of evidence of positive impact on care, but they don't spread. This is the dilemma that all of us in and around the innovation business are talking about. Karen talked about her terrific work in Pittsburgh. Why hasn't that spread to every city in the country? And I would posit that the reason is that we have failed macro systems. We haven't created the systems that would make it easy to do the right thing and that make it compelling to do the right thing. The Affordable Care Act, to the extent that it wasn't about coverage, was and is mostly about changing the macro systems in which providers and patients come together to do their important work. And that is all to the good. It's an historic increase in the positivity of those macro systems. Karen Davis talked about CMMI and its new authority to take positive changes in payment and spread them rapidly without congressional authority. That would be a huge potential impact on the macro systems in which providers and patients operate. Now, the Affordable Care Act is filled with tools like that. It is the most complete toolbox that we have ever had at our disposition in the history of our healthcare system. It has things like payments to reduce avoidable complications, value-based purchasing, Medicare Advantage plan bonuses, bundled payments, physician quality reporting, hospital quality reporting, Centers for Medical Homes, ACOs. This is not part of the Affordable Care Act, but I had to mention it. So we have all these great new pieces of equipment that we can use to kind of pull the levers of our macro system. It's great news, and yet it's also a problem, because we have so many macro system interventions occurring simultaneously right now that it is incredibly confusing to healthcare organizations. They often don't know which of these to pay attention to. What they usually do is prioritize the one that has the biggest impact on their budget, but they think may have the biggest impact on their budget. One of the challenges that we face going forward, assuming that political influences don't completely disrupt the Affordable Care Act going forward, is how to make sense of these tools, how to knit them into a comprehensive and effective and mutually reinforcing or synergistic set of interventions. That is a challenge that I don't think the Department of Health and Human Services has mastered for a lot of reasons, and I have enormous respect for my former colleagues there. But it's a lot to ask to do the kinds of things we need to do for the healthcare system with the tools that we now have at our disposal, under the time pressures they faced and under the political scrutiny they faced, and with the uncertainties they faced. So that's one reason why the Commonwealth Fund, and I had to talk about the Commonwealth Fund, put together this report called Confronting Costs, Stabilizing U.S. Health Spending While Moving Toward a High-Performance Healthcare System. Actually, it was the Commonwealth Fund Commission on a High-Performance Health System, which I chaired, that put this together. And its goal was to create incentives and structures for better care and lower costs throughout the continuum of healthcare services. It had a whole bunch of recommendations. To go through them all would take me to dessert. But there are other things you'd rather have for dessert. So I just want to point out that it is focused primarily on macro system, what we call macro system change, with three basic strategies: accelerating payment reforms to accelerate delivery system innovation, policies to expand and encourage high-value choices by consumers. There was some discussion today about the importance of involving consumers in better choices. And Karen had a, and Kathy and Stu had a great paper in Health Affairs about putting Medicare into a situation, creating a new plan that would encourage those choices, such better choices within the Medicare system. And then a series of other actions designed to make markets function better within healthcare. Now, fortunately, this was not the only report. Or maybe unfortunately, I don't know. Those of you who like reading reports may consider it fortunate. But there's been a lot of these came out in March, and I thought it was sort of the Medicare version of March Madness. But all these organizations, the Bipartisan Policy Centers, CAP, National Coalition on Healthcare, the Partnership for Sustainable Health, Bowles-Simpson, the Commonwealth Fund, and Brookings, all had reports within about 3 months of each other on how we should change the healthcare system, especially on the cost side. And to try to make it a little more consumable for this, the Commonwealth Fund is now trying to help, through a grantee, trying to help put these multiple reports together to see what they agree on, if anything, because there are Republicans and Democrats involved in these, and a lot of very smart people. And maybe there is an emerging consensus on what we ought to do. Well, in fact, there are a lot of shared ideas. Now, you could say this is a perfect example of herd mentality, or you could say these people ought to be here to tell us what the right way to go is. I don't know, but the agreement can be confirmed empirically. All of them are interested in provider payment reform, repeal the Medicare Sustainable Growth Rate formula, which we heard some about from Rick Foster today, moving from paying for volume to paying for value, enhancing support for primary care, we heard about that. Delivery system reform, tying payment to improvements in the healthcare delivery system, encouraging development and implementation of innovative delivery models, changing Medicare to improve the financial protection for beneficiaries, we heard about a catastrophic plan, we heard about trying to rationalize coinsurance and deductibles, and incentives, Karen, I think, mentioned this, incentives to beneficiaries to start making value-based or value-oriented choices in their consumption of healthcare. Consumer and patient engagement and changes in healthcare markets. So there is an emerging consensus among the cognoscenti of both parties about directions that we should go in trying to deal with what will be an enduring problem, whether or not the optimists are correct, an enduring problem of trying to reduce the waste and improve the efficiency of our healthcare system. Now, I have to tell you about IT. So I was planning to do this anyway, but I have a hook. And the hook is that I got a couple of calls today from reporters because the Department of Health and Human Services announced today, or yesterday, that 50% of eligible providers and 80% of hospitals that is eligible, non-hospital providers, and 80% of hospitals have now received payments for being meaningful users of electronic health records. That is a level that CBO predicted we would attain in 2019. Now, what is some more specific data? As somewhat outdated data, more than, at that point, almost 400,000 providers had registered for meaningful use, and new registrations were occurring at about 6,000 a month. At that point, $14 billion in payments had been made to about 260,000 unique providers. CBO predicted we would get to that level of outlay. Actually, they predicted that the level of outpay by 2013 would be about $7 billion. And a lot of these were eligible professionals, and most of those are physicians. So the rate of adoption of electronic health records, two different definitions. This is among physicians. This is the rate of adoption among hospitals. This is a this is 2011 data, so it's really at the point of implementation. So this is anticipatory. The reason why the data is late is that comparative national data on adoption, not on meaningful use, which is a CMS definition, but adoption separate from meaningful use, is only available through an American Hospital Association survey, which is delayed by a year or two for analysis. So I'd be happy to take questions. I'd also be happy to sit down. I do want to say that it's been a terrific experience for me to be able to attend these conferences for 20 years. They've been an important influence on my career, and I want to thank Stuart Nuva for giving me that opportunity, and I look forward to to tomorrow as well. Thanks very much for your attention.
There's the paradigm of choice, and there's the paradigm of systems. And you can't have both. So, you know, I think we're at a point where there's a lot of debate going on about, you know, locking people in. But, you know, I mean, this has particularly become very noticeable as we've been doing work on dual eligibles and vulnerable populations. So I wonder if you could reflect out loud about that and about how do we get the public to understand the benefits of being in a system and why they might want to trade off some of that choice?
So this is a question about public education. We should probably ask Ron about that.
Because it's not only the public, it's many policymakers as well.
I think we can't go one road or the other. I don't think it's politically viable. I think we've seen again and again that the public resists being locked in. I think we at some point, if we were going to truly take advantage of the benefit of systems, I think what we're going to have to do is work on the provider side to make it increasingly difficult for patients to find the physicians and the hospitals they want who are not working in systems. I think that that's in effect what's happening right now. Now, the alternative, which is a kind of reference pricing thing, which is that you give people the chance to purchase policies of different price, depending on whether it's a system related or not system related, I think is another approach, and I think we're likely to have some combination of those two. And it may work out that state by state, we see a lot of those differences built into the way states organize the Affordable Care Act. Yes, Fred.
David, first, appreciation for everything you've done to move the agenda forward and continue to move. My question is, most of what you've talked about is about the improvement of the healthcare system. What do you see as the prospects for the health of Americans?
It's a great question, and of course, if I knew the answer, I would be doing different things. But you know, there is—it's clearly true that behavior and socioeconomic factors are incredibly important influences on health levels.